This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show that trainers listen to, and I, of course, am Mike Penna with you for the next hour to visit with trainers and hear their stories, their lives, their backgrounds. And each and every week at this time, I have the distinct honor and privilege to talk to so many of the people that make this game a reality. And yes, I am talking about the trainers in our sport, and to hear their stories and to hear the similarities and the differences in the way that they have gotten into the sport and the ways that they have reached the pinnacle of their profession is simply amazing. And as a racing fan, I'm sure I speak for all of the racing fans out there. It's something that you're really going to enjoy as we continue to visit with trainers here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. And tonight's guest, certainly no exception. We're going to begin with trainer Bill White in the first half of the program, and David Canizzo will join us in the second half. So without further ado, we begin with the Illinois native and longtime resident of the Sunshine State. He has saddled 2,003 winners in a career spanning more than 30 years. His milestone win, number 2,000, came just recently on October 26th, and appropriately enough, it was achieved at the track he has called home for many years, Calder, in South Florida. And that win sounded like this.
Determinado leads the brigade to the top of the stretch. Determinado off the turn, and he's got a clear lead. Opens it out to 2.5, 3 lengths. Silver Cloud is out after him. Mel Beach through from the inside. Uno Caliente not doing enough. It's Determinado coming down to the final 16th of the Kaiser in search of win number 2,000 in the career of trainer Bill White, and they're going to get it. Determinado won it wire to wire. Silver Cloud was second, then Mel Beach.
Calder announcer Bobby Newman with the call. Bill, welcome to Trainer Talk, and I'm going to guess, I'll kind of go out on a limb here and say that that call probably sounds pretty good to you.
Well, Mike, thank you. I'm really thrilled to be on the show, and listening to that call, it almost made me feel as good listening to it now as it did a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, sounds pretty good on radio, just like it did in person, I'm sure. You know, your first win came with a $35,000 claiming horse, March 23rd, 1982. That was at Tampa Bay Downs. And now number 2,000 comes in the form of a stakes victory. You had said that that first win was the most exciting of your career. Do you still feel that way?
Well, yes. That actually was a $3,500. I saw an article where it said it was $35,000, but yeah, it was actually $3,500, and I think the purse at the time was $1,500. Actually, the truth is, I was teaching school at the time when I won that race and was just doing it as a hobby and didn't really know if I would ever have the opportunity to get into the game on a full-time basis. And it was just winning a race. It was something that I always wanted to do, thought I might be able to do. But when she won, I don't know if I've ever felt any more exhilarated about winning a race than that one. It was just like a childhood dream to just be part of the game and to walk down there knowing I had trained a horse that won. It was over the top special.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter the level. You talk about that being a $3,500 claimer, and I'm sure to you that felt as if you just won the Kentucky Derby.
It really did. I think I had run 12 or 13 times the same horse. That was my first horse and my only horse, a horse that I had bred and raised up. And it was like my 12th or 13th start, and she finally won. So it was a process even getting to that point. It made me appreciate winning a race is not automatic.
How about reaching a milestone like number 2,000? Does that make you stop and reflect upon how far your career has come and all the hard work and sacrifice that's gone along with that success?
Well, it really does. When you pull up some of the stuff on the internet and you look at it and you see the numbers that started in 1982, 83, and then you just keep watching year as you're flipping through it, you just watch year by year going by and you just realize, wow, that's a lot of time and that's a lot of horses running, a lot of dilemmas, a lot of good, a lot of bad. So when you look at it as an overview, yeah, you have an appreciation for that.
Several trainers have talked about the pressure that mounts as they get closer to a milestone win like that. Did you feel any additional pressure as you approached 2000?
Well, I kind of felt a little pressure in somewhat of a humorous way. The association here at Calder had let me know that they were aware that I was approaching that number. And I felt that maybe they would recognize that. So as we were sitting at 1,999, I knew every horse that I ran, they would kind of have to watch to see if the horse won or not. And if the horse had won, you know, the racing secretary and maybe some publicity people would come down. So I kind of laughed to myself. I said, oh my goodness, I hope we don't go into one of these 0-for-30 funks over a couple week period where everybody's having to stop what they're doing every time I'm running a horse. So we actually won that race pretty quickly after we had won 1999. And that was good to just get that over with.
Yeah, get it out of the way quickly. And, you know, one thing that's fascinated me, Bill, is that you've done this the old-fashioned way, so to speak, not having multiple stables around the country and several assistants. You've actually been the one to saddle each and every winner along the way, and that's impressive.
Well, that's really true, Mike. In the old days, most of your stables had 25 or 30 horses, regardless of how big the name of the trainer was. Woody Stevens, some of the all-time greats, they had 25, 30, maybe 40 horses. And these horses were all kept under one stable. So when you look back at their win totals, 2,000 is a big number for trainers in the past. And that was because stables were self-contained. You didn't have divisions. You didn't have 100 or 150 horses that were scattered throughout the country with assistance and stuff. So for us to get to 2,000, doing it the old-fashioned way, I say to some people about that, I said, it's kind of like eating an elephant one bite at a time.
But I can imagine that has to be extremely rewarding to know that you did it and did every step of the way on your own.
Yeah, it feels good. It's horses that every one of them were under my supervision. Every one of them, the decisions that brought them to the winner's circle, the races that were picked out, my interaction with the owners, it wasn't done partly by me and several assistants training strings of horses with horses that maybe I would just see once in a while or things like that. So, yes, there is a sense of self-satisfaction that it was done with me being part of all of it.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, Bill, and talking with trainer Bill White here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Growing up in Illinois, you didn't have a family that was prominent in the racing industry, but you did have a grandfather who was a racing fan. Is that how it all got started for you?
Absolutely. I was very close to my grandfather, who had a lifelong passion for the horses. He would tell me about seeing some of the horses of the past, War Admiral, Citation, old ruler. He would just tell me these stories about these horses and races he had seen, and he was just a big fan. And later on in his life, he fulfilled one of his fantasies. He was actually able to buy four or five racehorses, and he raced them at those little tracks in southern Illinois, Fairmont Park, which is currently still there, and a track that has closed many years ago, a little track called Cahokia Downs. Those two tracks ran a little circuit in southern Illinois. And when he had his racehorses, and I was about 7 or 8 years old, he would bring me out to the track. And I was the only family member that was really smitten by that whole process. And I knew even when I was a little kid and would go out to the races with him and listen to his stories and read the Blood Horse magazine and all that, I just, it was just like a fantasy. It's just something that I knew I wanted to do. I didn't know how I could go about getting into it, but I knew it was something I wanted to do. And I'm just very fortunate. As a young child, I had a goal, and I'm one of the guys that got to do what he wanted to do. What can you say?
Yeah, it's great to be able to fulfill a dream like that. And I think I had read a quote somewhere that said that you found out that racing, when you get into it and introduced to it, is, well, it's either you really like it or you just kind of shrug your shoulders and it doesn't do anything for you. What was it that appealed to you about the sport at that young age?
It was just the excitement of it. It just seemed to be bigger than life to me. The horses themselves were the superstars. Following a group of horses as they would run regularly and anticipating them to run back again. The jockeys, the top riders, whether it be on a national level or on the local level, you just look at them and they just seem to be something kind of like a rock star, just something really special, something really cool. And the trainers that were out there making it all happen, they were something that you just looked up to. And I was just really amazed by the whole thing and wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I can remember going to the races in Saratoga when I was a kid and chasing after the jockeys trying to get autographs on my program, and I probably still have several of those programs today from when they were nice enough to take the time to do that. Was that kind of your introduction to the sport as well, where you were just a fan and you're just trying to be around it and you looked up to those individuals, jockeys and trainers that were participating?
Yeah, that's really true. Although my grandfather was an owner, most owners, including my grandfather, really didn't have a lot to do with the day-to-day training or maintenance of the horses. They would come and go and visit the barn and go to the races and talk to the trainers. So my background was that through the eyes of an owner or a race fan, rather than someone who was actually in the shed row in the trenches.
When you were 16, your family moved to Clearwater, Florida. You were close to Tampa Bay Downs, but that was more frustrating than rewarding at that time, wasn't it?
Well, that was a real eye-opener for me, where I had been allowed as a kid in Illinois to go to the track as long as I was with an adult and go to the backside, have free access to the racetrack. So when my parents decided to move to Clearwater, which meant leaving my grandfather in southern Illinois, which I wasn't real enthused about that.
Yeah, how hard was that?
But at least I knew right off the bat, I knew in the Clearwater area, Tampa Bay Downs had its little short winter meet. So I took a little solace in that, well, at least there's racing there and whatever. Well, sure enough, I was a junior in high school. I went to Largo High School. That's in the Clearwater, St. Pete area. And I had my father one day on a weekend take me to Tampa Bay Downs. I was all fired up. The meet had finally opened. It was a winter meet. I was all enthused. Never had seen Tampa before, although it was called, I think, Florida Downs at the time. And maybe even Sunshine Park back then. Went from Sunshine Park to Florida Downs to Tampa Bay Downs. That's the three names these have. But we got there, and with all my anticipation and looking forward to the track, we approached the entrance gate. And as we were looking to get in, the admittance person there looked at me and said, are you 21? And I said, no, I'm 16, 15, whatever it was. And they said, well, we're sorry, we can't let you in. And that was the first time I realized that in Florida at the time, to get into any paramutual facility, you had to be 21 years old. And I absolutely couldn't believe it. I said, what kind of backward state have I moved to? And I was essentially boxed right out of horse racing at that point. There was just, I had no access to it in any way, shape, or form.
Well, and I guess that meant that you had to start focusing on your education, and actually after going through high school and attending the University of South Florida, started pursuing other careers outside of horse racing. Is that right?
That's correct. I pretty much forgot about horse racing as far as my involvement as it had been. And I got in school, I graduated from Largo High School, and I eventually went to the University of South Florida in Tampa. Graduated, I thought about going into law, but I got a teaching degree, my bachelor's, and then I went for a master's. And I actually then wound up getting a teaching job in Sarasota, Florida, which is about 50 miles south of the Largo and Clearwater area. And I taught school for about 6 years.
Now, when you were going through college and away from the sport, as you mentioned, were you still following the game at that point as a fan, or did you just completely distance yourself from horse racing?
Well, I had distanced myself for a while, but somewhere along the line, Florida did reduce the age down to 18, along with the voting and everything was during that time. So by the time they backed your entrance up to 18, then I could go back to the track. And I remember at Tampa starting to go to the races again while I was in college. I commuted. I actually lived at home in the Largo area and drove 35, 40 miles to the University of South Florida. And I remember oftentimes being a little low on money, and I would purposely, on my way back from class, swing by the track, try to catch the last few races and see if I could make a bet in order to get enough spending money or gas money to keep me going. So, yeah, I got back involved again and really enjoyed that.
What happened when you didn't win your bet?
Well, I had to make sure I at least had enough gas money to get home from the track, that's for sure. But I remember I remember betting horses the show, and if I could get a $3.20 mutual on a $10 wager, where I'd come out of there with $7 or $8. Well, back then, gas was 40, 50 cents a gallon. So if I could come out of there with $7 or $8, I was living large. I felt good about that.
Talking with trainer Bill White on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you mentioned your first winter, and now you mentioned teaching school. So you were kind of a full-time teacher, but moonlighting as a horse trainer, and you had to run most of your horses on the weekends so it wouldn't interfere with your regular job, so to speak. You had to take off of work, though, to run your very first winter. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I had my one horse that her name was Fat Two, and I bred and raised her up. And my wife, who was a horse person mostly in the show world, she would actually get on the horse, and we trained her in a show ring in Sarasota in just a riding stable. And this is when I started getting back into it again. I got my trainer's license, start hanging around the track. I start meeting people and getting to know the lay of the land. And we were training this one filly, and what we were doing is on the weekends during the winter when Tampa was running, I'd enter a race and we'd take her over. That was a whole lot of fun. But we were getting near the end of the meet, and the opportunities to run were getting a little slimmer. And a race came up. It was on a weekday during school. Now, I'm teaching. I'm a full-time teacher. So I get this filly in in the middle of the week. Now I have a horse in a race at Tampa, and I'm supposed to be teaching that day. So teachers do have a certain number of sick days that they can call in sick. And I did that. I called in sick because I wanted to run my horse. So we loaded her up on a trailer. We took her over to Tampa. She was something 25-30 to 1. I had a buck boy on her that God only knows whatever happened to him. I can remember his name was Doug Copeland. 7-pound bug. She was a filly running against the colts because, like I say, there weren't too many races left. We were near the end of the meet, and put her in the race. And I told the bug boy, I said, if she breaks good, just let her run. And she broke good, took the lead, and incredibly, much to everybody surprised me, the rider, and I'm sure the fans that let a 25-to-1 shot get away. She went wire to wire, held on, losing the lead, but held on and won by a fast diminishing half length. Wow, what a thrill.
Wow, what a thrill. And 2,000 wins later, you're still experiencing those thrills. Talk about the decision you had to make to base your operation at Calder in South Florida.
Well, what happened was, as I was running and running this filly and hanging around Tampa Bay Downs, I started to meet people. And I happened to meet a man named Burton Butker, who had 10 horses or more and lived in Sarasota, exactly where I was. So I would go over to his place where he had a little farm, 10-acre farm, and I would visit it and check his horses out. Well, about a year after I had won my first race, I got a surprise phone call from him when he asked me if I had ever wanted to seriously train horses, and said he had horses up in New Jersey that he was going to bring down, and he didn't. His trainer in New Jersey wasn't going to come. So he had asked me if I had ever wanted to train, and I said I would. So he told me, he says, if you want to train the horses, I'll give them to you, and I'll guarantee you I'll back you for a year no matter what. And I had a big, big decision to make at that time, an opportunity to do whatever I wanted to do my whole life. But that meant I had to walk away from teaching. And I thought about it. I discussed it with my wife. I look back at that decision now in disbelief, but I actually walked into the same principal's office who a year before I had called in sick, and who, by the way, I was so proud of winning the race, even though I had called in sick, I showed him the win photo anyway, and he took it good-naturedly. So he knew what I was getting involved with, and I actually gave notice and walked away from my teaching career and ran to the racetrack. Decision that I look back now and I just kind of shake my head.
Yeah, and it looks like that's been the right decision. In 2005, you were inducted into Calder's Hall of Fame. What does that mean to you, Bill?
Well, it is, you know, a Hall of Fame on a local level, but the people that are in there in the Hall of Fame is quite surprising. You have trainers like Frank Gomez, Eddie Pleasa, Marty Wilson. You have owners in the Calder Hall of Fame like Fred Hooper and many others. So there's been a lot of real quality, great people that have come through Calder that are still in the game, jockeys, owners, and trainers. Calder has always been kind of a proving ground for people, and some of the biggest names in the game at one time have been part of Calder. So to be in the Calder Hall of Fame, it feels good.
Now, you've been responsible for starting the careers of some of the most prominent runners that we have in the sport today. Breeders' Cup Turf winner Little Mike, Breeders' Cup Classic winner Mucho Macho Man, all started with you. What's that like for you, Bill? Is it rewarding, frustrating? Where do those emotions lie?
Well, certainly when you see some of my previous horses that I developed winning on the big stage, certainly I'd like to get on the wave one time and ride it myself. That's what we all look for. We all look for having a good horse and get to experience that. The plus and minus of being at Calder, the plus is when you're down in South Florida, since there's year-round racing, you can actually have a home life, have a family, and do all those sort of things and still be part of the track. And years ago, after my first few years of traveling the circuit, going to some of the little tracks like River Downs and Finger Lakes and Atlantic City along with Tampa, after doing that for 3 years, I just decided that living in efficiency apartments and traveling around, it just wasn't something I wanted to do. And being a Florida guy at that time, knowing Miami had year-round racing, I decided to make my stand here. So the plus is you get to live a normal life. You get to, if you want to coach Little League Baseball, you can do that. You go home and sleep in your same bed 365 days a week, have a family. So I put that on the forefront. The downside to it, though, is when you develop some really quality horses and you're sitting right down here in the tip of Florida, 1,000 miles removed from any other racetrack with limited possibilities stake-wise for a serious horse outside of the Gulfstream meet, it really becomes problematic to campaign a serious horse from these headquarters. So in many of these situations, some of these good horses that I have developed, the ownership has decided that in order to campaign them throughout the country, you can't do it from a Calder home base.
He's trainer Bill White here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Bill, hard to believe we're just about out of time. This has really flown by. Could have spent another half an hour easy hearing your story and so many things we didn't get to. So I'll have to have you promise to join us again up the road, and we'll do Bill White part two.
Thank you very much. It's not often you get to brag about yourself for 25 minutes.
Well, you did a great job, my friend, and thanks so much for being here with us. All of our guests who appear live on Trainer Talk will receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get those out to you. And again, thanks so much for taking the time, Bill.
You got it. Thank you.
Enjoyable visit, trainer Bill White. Here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Second half coming up next. Stay tuned here on HRN. Fasig Tipton, where will you be? Make plans now to attend the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mix Sale on December 9th, and be sure to nominate your horse to the Kentucky Winter Mix Sale by December 9th, sale date February 10th. And things really start heating up March 24th with the Florida Sale. For more information, visit FasigTipton.com. That's FasigTipton.com. Fasig Tipton, where will you be? I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, maker of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, how do Flair strips, when applied to a horse's nose, help protect their lungs?
Mike, studies show that 90% of the resistance to airflow in exercising horses is in the upper airway, with the majority of that being in the nose. When exercising at high intensity, many horses can bleed into their lungs. The strips have been shown to reduce that bleeding by reducing the resistance to airflow through the nasal passages. This keeps horses healthy by keeping their lungs healthier during performance and training.
To learn more, visit FlairStrips.com. On Wednesday, November 27th, the eyes of the racing world will be focused on Penn National Racecourse as many of the country's top sprinters highlight the $250,000 Fabulous Strike Handicap on Thanksgiving Eve. First post is 6 p.m., and the evening will feature an all-stakes early pick four culminating with the $250,000 Fabulous Strike as race number four. The night before Thanksgiving, feast on a terrific plate of steaks at Penn National. Visit hcpn.com/racing for more information.
The $1 million Delta Downs jackpot, Saturday, November 23rd. Delta Downs Racetrack, Casino, and Hotel in Vinton, Louisiana is running 11 exciting thoroughbred races worth over $2 million in purses. First post time is 1:15 p.m. Central. The jackpot goes off at 4:15. Bet with the big money and play the $200,000 guaranteed jackpot day all stakes pick four. You could really hit the jackpot. For all the action on November 23rd, watch it live on DRF.com, DRF Bets, or at a simulcast location near you. For more information about the $1 million Delta Downs jackpot, keep reading Daily Racing Form or visit DRF.com and DeltaDownsJackpot.com.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Faisal Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna broadcasting from our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Really fun visit in the first half of the program. If you missed any portion of this show, go back to our website. Later on this evening, a podcast will be available for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, so you can listen at your leisure and listen to all of our Trainer Talk shows archived on our special Trainer Talk page, all at horseracingradio.net. Our next guest joins us from New York. It is New York native David Canizzo. He has, to date, saddled 19 career winners, his best year coming this year, 8 winners so far, and really on a roll, and nice enough to take some time to join us here tonight. David, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to hear from you.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, it's funny because we talked to so many trainers on this program who have reached pinnacles of 2,000, 3,000 career victories. Do you ever allow yourself to dream that big, or is reaching a number like that something you think about as kind of a goal for yourself up the road?
It's always a goal for you. Right now we're just trying to get to 100, I guess, is where you would start at, but in the back of your mind and dreaming big, you always hope to hit the thousands.
Yeah, is that something as a trainer you consciously do in terms of setting goals like that? I know athletes will say, okay, I want to, you know, get myself to this level. Will you do that as a trainer as well?
Yes, sir. As an athlete in high school too, in college, you always think about stuff like that, also setting goals. And in your mindset as a trainer, you have to do the same sort of things and always hope for the best and want to sort of set a goal, say, you know, I'm going to try and win 5 this month or 10 this month, and just sort of reach for it and see what there is, what you're missing, and what you can do better to make your stable thrive and reach those goals, actually.
You were an athlete in school. What sports did you play?
I was an All-American lacrosse player in high school and college. So.
Wow, nice. Do you still follow the sport?
Yeah, once in a while. I mean, you know as well as I do the business we're in, you don't have much time to think about anything but horses, so when I have a chance or it's on TV or if I can check a game out here in Long Island, go to Hofstra and watch a game, I definitely do. And I try and reach out. And if I'm ever home upstate and hook up with some of my old college and high school coaches, it's always nice to go back and try and help out as best you can.
Yeah. Now, where did you play college?
I played at Oswego State.
Okay. All right. And It's interesting because you mentioned not having a lot of time to follow other things beside horse racing. I typically end our trainer talk interviews by asking trainers what they like to do outside of racing. And the common answer is, well, I have these other hobbies, but I never get a chance to do them.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you'd love to do, love to have time. I mean, you don't get to see family too much. Luckily, in my family, we're pretty much all in the same sort of business in different areas. But I do like to fish. I love to play sports and watch sports. And I mean, most of the time outside the business, you're just looking to relax and sort of take it easy because you've been flat out every day, 7 days a week, you know? So when you have a minute to catch up and relax, it's getting other stuff done, whether it's laundry to anything around the house.
Yeah, now you grew up in a racing family, your whole family involved with the sport on some level. Your dad is a trainer. Take us back to the beginning and talk about growing up in a racing household.
Grew up in a racing household. It's almost like it's meant for you to do it. Obviously, my father and mother, you know, they tried to push you away from it. You know, they want to see you go out and better your life or do something. But it always is something your natural, you know, instincts to do is to go back to the barn. Jeff, my brother, is the director of New York Breeding, and, you know, we both went to school, got away from it, but it draws you back in, and it's just what you're meant to do, I guess you could say. Growing up, it was different than a normal, you know, kid that grew up in middle school and high school. On the weekends, you're not going to sleep over to friends. You're going, I want to go with Dad to the barn, and you're waking up at 4:30 on a Saturday to go to the track instead of sleeping until 10 and waking up and playing video games with your friends. So it's sort of a different livelihood and life that you live growing up as a kid in a racetrack family, I would say.
Did your dad actually push you away from it, as you mentioned, when you told him that you wanted to be a trainer?
Not really. He was, you know, he took it in stride. That's what you want to do, then do it. But he just made sure him and my mother both get a college degree so you always have something to fall back on if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And Jeff and I both did that, and it was something that I hold in the back of my heart. You know, I have 3 degrees, business administration, telecommunications, and animal science degree. So it's sort of like it's always there if I need it, and we can fall back on it if we have to.
Did you ever consider putting those degrees to work and doing something other than being around the racetrack and training horses?
I actually did at one point. I said, you know, you work so hard every day at the barn, wouldn't you rather just have a normal life? And I always thought, because I have a telecommunications degree in audio video broadcasting, that I could go to work for like TVG or do the NYRA network or something, but I just never really went into it. I did an internship at Channel 5 Sports in Syracuse after school, and it just, I mean, you know as well as I do, when are all sporting events? It's at night. So I'd be cutting highlights and stuff and going to games till 1 a.m. You come back and your whole, it's like a total time difference. Your friends are going home and you're just, I mean, they're going out and you're just going to work. You know what I mean? So it's hard. So I always thought in the background you could always do something like that or, you know, it's always there. Something to fall back on, Mike.
Well, you know, training horses, as you kind of alluded to, is not an easy profession. It's not for everybody. Is there ever a time that you sit and wonder, boy, what am I doing? Did I make the right call?
You think about it sometimes, but right now I'm pretty happy where I am, happy with the way the stable's grown, and I just keep punching and going forward, you know? So it crosses your mind. You have a month where you go 0 for 10 or 12, and in the back of your mind you're like, what am I doing? Am I throwing time away? Am I wasting my time? Am I doing something wrong? But at the end of the day, you just put your head down and keep working. And, I mean, everybody has slumps and everybody goes through it. So you just have to keep going on with the punches.
So what ultimately made you decide to follow in your father's footsteps?
I just love it, Mike. I'm not going to lie to you. I love being around the track. I love the animals. I put my heart and soul into it. And it's just a natural love that I can't get away. Even when I was in college and you're not around the barn that much, it used to drive me insane to not be there. I can remember at Oswego State being in lecture halls and I'd have my laptop. I'd be watching Twin Spires, watching races in the middle of a class, not even focused on what's going on in class. And then like, it just, when you got it in your blood and you have the fever, you can't get away from it.
You were able to get all those degrees without actually focusing on the class?
Oh, I never, ever, ever focused. I'd always be worrying who's in, where they ran, who's in tomorrow. I was, horse racing is probably a downfall on my career.
With your dad being a trainer, does that create more pressure for you, or is it not really an issue?
It's not really an issue. It helps. Like, he sort of lives through Jeff and I because he was at Finger Lakes. He never really got out of the Finger Lakes world. So when he sees us win, me win in Belmont and Saratoga, it really makes him happy. So it's almost like he lives through us. You know, he's got Jeff going to the Breeders' Cup, handling big-time business, me winning races on the big-time scale. So it's like he sort of lives through us more than me in his shadow, you know?
Will you still talk to him about some of the horses that you're training or seek any advice from him, like a typical father-son relationship?
We talk daily. I talk to him two or three times a day. He's my number one critic. If a horse runs bad, why'd you run him there? Why'd you ride that guy on the horse? It's just, he's abusive about some things. But, you know, like, it's a typical father-son, whether it was you playing baseball, you struck out. Man, you should have hit the curveball. It's the same thing. Why'd you send him, you know? If you sat the trip, you might have got a better trip, better result. So, yeah, I mean, we critique each other just like I watch his horses run, and I abuse him back about stuff that he does. So it's very cool. A lot of people probably don't have families like that, but we talk every night between Jeff and him and the three of us talking about, you know, our business and what's going on. It's nice to have another input, I guess you could say, than just going home and looking at your wife and her saying to you, how'd you do today, you know? There's always two or three people in my family watching my horses run.
Yeah, I can imagine that has to be special to have that element within your family and within those relationships. It certainly has to strengthen those relationships because you do have that common ground.
Oh, it strengthens it, but sometimes it weakens it, trust me. When they abuse you or pick on you, I pick on him about a horse can be, it eats away at it a lot, but it does strengthen it in other areas.
What's the best advice or the advice that you remember most that your dad had given to you or has given to you over the years?
The number one thing my dad probably used to say to me, and he's totally right, and I can even say Dale Roman said the same thing to me when I worked for him, is there isn't much difference between Finger Lakes and New York and anywhere you go. It's all, the only scale that's different is probably the money scale. You have the same horses, just different prices, same people. It's all a different scale. So don't ever look at people or think like, oh, he came from Finger Lakes or he came from Penn National and now he's in Saratoga. It's the same people, same work ethic, and same kind of horses. It's just at a higher scale. So don't ever put yourself ahead of someone that's lower than you. In a physical standpoint, like if a handicapper was looking at the form and they see Todd Pletcher versus Charlie Baker for some guy from a smaller track, they're going to bet Todd Pletcher just because the name sticks out. But you can't do that because in any day, anybody can beat anyone. So that's the main thing he told me. Don't ever get in that mindset of thinking you're better than someone because you're at Belmont Park.
Yeah, what's it like for you? You're going up against Todd Pletcher and Bill Mott and these outstanding, Nick Zito, these Hall of Famers on a day-in, day-out basis with having a smaller operation, really trying to make your mark right now. What's that like for you?
I like it. It's almost like you're the underdog, so when you do win, you shock the world. You know what I mean? They don't expect you to beat them, so when you do, it's almost bittersweet.
David Canizzo, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, you go back to your dad in Finger Lakes, and I know obviously that's a track that you're very familiar with, hanging out with him and around his operation as a kid. We talked with Jeremiah Engelhart a couple of weeks ago on this very same show, and he told us his story right before winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. And I'm wondering if there's a sense of pride that comes from you with having a guy like Jeremiah starting at Finger Lakes, now succeeds on the big stage, and is there a bit of a fraternity with trainers who started at a track like Finger Lakes?
You always like to see it because it's like, that's where we grew up. It's where we learned what we learned. It's where we loved to live when we were younger. In a perfect world, they could transplant Belmont or Saratoga there, and I'd be in my glory just for the area, and not being in the city would be awesome. But you always want to see people you grew up with do good. It's almost like that karma. It's a good karma to root for them because they're like yourself. they're always the underdog, and you want to see them do good. And it's like you're saying, it's almost like a fraternity or something like that, because we grew up together, and it's just good to see those people do good.
So how did you get started training horses on your own? What year was that, and how did it all occur?
I started about a year ago full-fledged on my own. I started some horses in my name before in between other jobs. I've been in New York 11 years now. I worked for Dale Romans for 2.5 years. He left New York to go back to Kentucky, so I stayed here. I then went to work for Scott Lake as Scott's assistant for about 5 years. And when Scott pulled out of New York, I went to work for Bruce Levine for 3 years, and I got an offer from a guy out of Texas, Moneyball Ace, and he had some cheaper horses and wanted to send me 8, 9 horses. So I said, it's not every day someone can send you 8 or 9. That's a number that you can start with. Any day of the week, anyone could walk around and find 1 or 2 horses to train on your own. But what are you going to do with 1 or 2 horses? You're not going to survive. You're not going to make enough money to make ends meet. So when I had the opportunity, I talked to Bruce, and he said, you can always go back to being an assistant. Take the opportunity while it's there. And that's what I did. I took a shot. Those horses really couldn't cut it in New York last year, but I grinded it out, got a few better clients, built my barn up to 28 horses right now, and things are going very good.
Well, you mentioned the name of Eclipse Award-winning trainer Dale Romans, and that was your very first job on the track, was working with Dale?
Well, besides the thing, my first job in New York
yep.
was working for Dale.
Yep. Well, yeah. We can get into the good stories now. What was it like working with Dale?
It was very good. I sort of got thrown into the, you know, into the fire because Dale's in Kentucky and I was here in New York. So I had to show I knew what I was doing at a very young age. I was 21 and just started rocking and rolling for Dale. So it was good. But it was good. He was a great boss. Never bothered you. If you had something to tell him or wanted to talk about something, you could call him and get right to the point. And it was good to work for someone like that right off the bat because I was around good horses. My first year with him was the last year that he had kids join Roses and May. So I was around high power, high quality type of animals. And it gave me a fire to get to that level, I guess you could say.
We hear so many trainers on the program talk about the different things they learn from other trainers that they're around along the way. You mentioned Dale Romans, Scott Lake, Bruce Levine. What are some of the things that you've taken away from each one of those trainers that you're still incorporating today?
I've learned different aspects from all of them. I mean, the number one thing that I agree and I probably could tell people to do is some people work for one guy for a long time and then go out on their own. You sort of get stuck in their style. Where I am today, I worked for my father. I dealt with cheap horses at Finger Lakes. I had real good babies and real nice stake horses with Dale. With Scott, I had a lot of high-priced claimers and claiming horses. With Bruce, it was more well-rounded. We had New York breds. We claimed a lot of horses for Rapoli. And, you know, I had depth. So I had, as a background, a lot of different aspects of training, different types of horses, quality of horses. And I think it just made me more well-rounded. Like, with Dale, he showed me how to get babies ready and run, you know, train on one and get a horse ready for a big race. With Scott, it was, more the complete opposite. We had a lot of sore-type claiming horses that we had to get right to jam and win races. And different styles of training from the hard to the light to the easy, taking easy, backing off one, making them happy. You know, so I got a pretty good education throughout working for multiple different peoples with multiple styles, I guess you could say.
Coming from Finger Lakes and working with horses that weren't the caliber of a Kitten's Joy, let's say, was it a bit intimidating when you first started working around some of those better horses?
No, because when you went from working with sore horses at Finger Lakes and cheap horses that if you didn't get in the win, you weren't getting dinner that night. You had to make money to survive at Finger Lakes growing up. And then you come to New York and work around good horses. You see a lot of similarities. That horse at Finger Lakes might have a tendon. This horse in New York does too. And they're just same sort of horses running for a lot bigger money, I guess you could say. So, I mean, it's a lot more pressure on you, I could say that, when you have a $5,000 horse in your hands or a $500,000 horse in your hands. Yes, there's a lot more pressure from owners, from people like that. But all in all, a horse is a horse. They all should be treated equally and taken care of. So any way you look at it, there's no difference in taking care of them. A little bit more pressure from the clientele.
Yeah, so what is David Canizzo's philosophy on training horses and running your operation?
My number one philosophy, it might sound funny to people, but what I totally believe is do not train each horse like an assembly. Each horse is their own. Every horse needs their own style of training and my mental preparation to, you know, perfect one style for that horse. There's a lot of outfits out here that they get stuck in that assembly line mode where if they have 100 horses, it's everything gets done the same, and you can't. You have to look at each horse as a specific individual and come up with a program for that horse. You can't go Sunday's a walk day, Monday's a jog day, Tuesday's a gallop day. Each horse needs their own program, and that's sort of what I live by, just individualization between each horse, you know? So I say that's my number one thing that I really, really try to do is don't treat two horses alike. Give everybody their own style and their own program and just stick to it.
What would you consider to be the greatest training job that you've done to this point, David?
There's a few of them that I really like to look back to. But one that really touched my mind is River Dancer. I bought him in the OBS Marcel as a two-year-old. Had him ready first time. He wins going three-quarters on the grass at Belmont. He ran 109 flat. And it was the first two-year-old turf race. So then I had to come off, I think it was like a 53-day layoff into the grade two at Saratoga with anticipation. And he ran his eyeballs out. We caught a really hard, firm turf, and Todd Fletcher got the lead. I just couldn't catch him, but we ran a bang-up second. And I just, you know, I think I did a excellent job having him ready off of one sprint and a 57-day layoff to get him ready to go a mile and a 16th in a grade two. I'd say that's pretty impressive. Or just little, there's other little things that I like to think I did a good job with, like a horse like Schmooze Talker that I claimed for 20 and ran out 120,000 and won four races with this year. Or even a horse, I claimed a horse at Finger Lakes probably a month and a half ago in Spite of the Gold for 5,000 that I thought had a huge turf pedigree, being by Spicetown out of a Red Ransom mare. Center long, first time going long, a mile 16th here at Aqueduct the other day for 16, and she runs a bang up second. Things like that really make me feel good being able to move a horse up, I guess I would say.
How about the training job or the horse that you say, man, I'd like to have that one back? I was close, but if I had just done this, I think things would have been different. Is there a story like that?
Little honor, but not like that really stick out. I mean, there's a lot of them where you didn't really crank on them and you ran a short horse or they got in trouble or I came with a bonehead decision of, you know, there's not much speed and you put them on the lead and you take the run out of them a little bit. Stuff like that there is, but none that really stick out in my head, you know. So I can't really say, you know, anything negative about any decisions I've really made right now that really stick out. There's a bunch of little stuff where you think you're the lone speed, but you really can't clear a horse, and you end up beating yourself up going head-to-head 22:45, then turn for home, you're out of gas, and you end up getting eased. That stuff drives you nuts, yes. But I can't really pinpoint a certain instance that happens.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that there's races where you think you're lone speed or you think you're maybe the horse is going to come from behind or whatever the case may be. Talk about your preparation when you're entering horses into certain races and finding the right spots for each individual horse. What's the preparation like that goes into spotting your horses?
You always want to find the perfect spot. When I look at a condition book, this is one thing Scott Lake taught me. He said, always have every condition book. Just because you're in New York, don't have New York's book. Have Philadelphia, Penn, National, Delaware, because no matter where they're standing in the winner's circle, they always pay you the same. Correct? So he always tells, try and find the best spot. You want to be 3-5. You don't want to be 20-1. So the main thing is try and find the perfect spot for each horse. If you've got a horse that's a sprinter and you're saying, hey, can he get 7-8? Can he get a mile? Don't do it. Because if you have to second guess yourself, you're probably making the wrong decision. So I would say go with your gut feeling, what you think is the best spot for you, and you're going to be the shortest price and the solidest horse you can be.
Yeah, I think that a lot of fans don't realize the efforts and the time that trainers take when they're looking at putting their horses in a certain race. It's not as simple as just opening up the condition book and entering your horse into a specific spot. There's a lot more that goes into it.
It's an old saying that I remember from when I was a little kid. I've never seen an ugly horse in the winner's circle.
Yeah, very well said. Trainer David Canizzo joining us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So you mentioned your lacrosse background and your sporting background. Are there things that you've taken away from athletics that drive you and help you in what you're doing now with training horses?
I would say the number one thing is I had a high school lacrosse coach that really used to drive mental toughness into you. You can't ever get down on yourself. If you gave up a few goals, don't get down. The game isn't over till the whistle is over. So I guess that's the same sort of thing is if you had a bad week, you went 0-6 this week, there's always next week. You're always going to make another start if that horse is okay. So don't beat yourself up on a bad performance or a bad day. So I would say the number one thing I learned from sports and taking it into horse racing is mental toughness.
Yeah, as a young trainer, David, and somebody who really is just starting his career, how often can you or how easy is it to get sucked into that pattern of getting down and getting depressed when things aren't going your way?
Oh, it's very easy because you want the best to happen all the time and just sometimes it can't. It just can't happen and it's not going to go your way. And you get sucked into, man, I'm terrible. Man, what did I do wrong? Dude, it was a bad ride. I can't ride him anymore. And the worst thing I think you do, because I've caught myself doing it, I see a lot of young trainers do it too, is you get down and you start changing everything from riders to the way you're training to exercise riders to help. And you can't do that. You sort of got to just stick in the trench and keep going and keep going, and it'll turn. Because when you start changing everything, then you're getting out of that routine, your horses are getting out of the routine, and you're getting out of the routine, and it just it starts hurting you because then you're making a negative situation into a very negative situation.
Yeah, and then it becomes an endless situation that continues to feed off of itself, and it seems to get worse rather than better, doesn't it?
Yes, a very, very true statement.
Well, let's switch gears just a little bit. You recently became an uncle.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, congratulations. What's that like?
Thank you very much. It's good. It's an honor to see Jeff having a kid, but it's nice. You know, it shows that we're growing up and where we're going, you know. I drove up to Albany 2 weeks ago and saw her, and it was good. It was very good. She's a cute little thing, and I'm very happy about him. I'm happy for him. His life's changing in the right direction, and he's in a good place now, and it gives me something to look forward to.
Yeah, does having your family so close and that close-knit element that you described earlier with your family, does that help you get through some of those tough times, or do those members of your family make it a little bit worse on you?
No, it helps. I mean, it's always like having a support system. They know when one runs bad, and, you know, I'm probably down, the call changes subject, or shoot me a text, hey, they run bad, got steady, got in a ton of trouble, don't worry about it. It's always good having a built-in support system, I guess you could say.
Well, David, just about 2 minutes left before we have to wrap things up. But what does the future hold for David Canizzo Racing Stable?
Big things. Just growing, getting some better quality animals. We've already bought 5 yearlings this year for next year, spent some good money. And just hoping to get a few things going in the right direction. Get a few of my big 2-year-olds that won some races. We gave some time off. Get them ready for a big 3-year-old campaign. And hopefully leave our mark on New York.
Do you pick out those yearlings yourself when you go to the sale?
Yes, a few of my owners, I have the luxury of some good guys that let me sort of pick what I want and do what I want. And we had good success. We bought 5 2-year-olds this year. 4 of them are winners. One's great in stakes place. The other one is stakes place. And, I mean, we've done well at the sales. So hopefully I really enjoy going to the sales and picking out babies because it's just, it's something you get to see unfold in front of you and build on, and I really like that aspect of the game, you know, and it's a different aspect than claiming a horse and trying to move it up. You buy a yearling or a 2-year-old and get to build on it and form that horse into what you want it to be.
He's trainer David Canizzo here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. David, just about out of time, but thank you so much for being our guest here tonight. Really enjoyed hearing your story. All of our guests receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get those out to you. And again, thanks so much and all the best as you launch that career of yours. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Anytime.
All right, Trainer David Canizzo here on Trainer Talk. If you missed any portion of this show, go back and check out the podcast on our website later on this afternoon, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. For Lee Delapina, our producer, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time.